I do love that song. There's a fountain open for all. Not everybody realizes they're thirsty. but we are, and we can be satisfied there. We're grateful that you're here tonight to worship God, that you thought it worthwhile to leave the yard and the garden and other things that you maybe could do and come and support these services with your attendance and with your prayers. It's good to see some folks from our own congregation and other places, and we trust that you've come praying, all of you, that God's will be established among us. Tonight we want to look at some events that occurred in what we've come to call Passion Week, the last week that Jesus was here on earth. The events in Luke 20 fall into that time period. What we come to know is Passion Week began on the first day of that week when Jesus rode that donkey into Jerusalem and accepted the praise of the crowd. And immediately after that, either yet that same day or the next day, probably that same day, he went into the temple, and for the second time, at least in his ministry, he drove out the money changers and their wares, and that really rubbed the hair the wrong way for the chief priests and the scribes and the elders. They had about enough of him already, and then he came in and upset their program. The next few days were days that were busy and intense, full of teaching, confrontation, challenge, and betrayal. In that week, Jesus went into an upper room, spent one evening there with his disciples, where he washed their feet, and together they shared some unleavened bread. And he told them, "This has special significance. This will represent my broken body." And they took a cup, the cup after supper, it says, and they shared it as a symbol of his blood that would soon be shed as the sacrifice of the new covenant. The week ended with Jesus in the tomb. Jesus had taught many things in that short time that he ministered to the people and traveled up and down the countryside. One of the things he taught were, "Blessed are the peacemakers, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." He had also taught, though, "Think not that I am come to bring peace on the earth. I came not to send peace, but a sword." And that last week, as Jesus presented himself in no undeniable terms as the Anointed One, the Messiah, the Christ sent down from heaven, he preached righteousness and truth. He brought a sword. There was division. It brought conflict, and it built and intensified practically by the hour until his enemies got Pilate into a corner, as it were, and got him to agree to nail Jesus to a cross. The events in Luke chapter 20 are part of this back and forth as the tension was building and the confrontations were going on and the pressure was increasing between Jesus and his adversaries. And again, we'll go back and look at just briefly at the early part of the chapter to get a background. In the first part of the chapter there, Jesus is challenged as to why or how he got the authority to just come into their temple and change things all around, chase out the money changers and the animals that were being used for sacrifice and all that. Who gave you that authority? That event occurred just at the end of the chapter before. Now here he is being questioned about it. Now, he could have come out and told them, "Look, I'm the Messiah. I came down from heaven. I'm doing the will of my Father, and that's the way it is." But Jesus was in control. And such a direct answer would have probably sent them over the edge, and the time was not yet. He knew how to answer, and so instead of giving him a direct answer, he said, I'm going to ask you a question. The baptism of John, was it from heaven or was it from men? Well, they weren't about ready to accept this man as the Messiah. They had already rejected the message of John the Baptist, who said there was a Messiah following. They did not believe what John said. They did not go get baptized. The common folk did. But they knew too much. They weren't going to do that. And they said, well, they reasoned, if we say that John the Baptist's message was from heaven, they'll say, well, why didn't you listen to him then? Why didn't you follow him? Why didn't you participate in what he taught and what he did? But if we say it's from men, too many people like John the Baptist, they'll stone us. They said, well, we don't know. We can't figure that out. He said, yeah, you're not answering me. I won't answer you. They were not able to pin Jesus down with that one. And then he told the parable of the vine growers, or the parable of the husbandmen. And in that parable, you'll remember that these unscrupulous vineyard keepers had plotted to get the vineyard by doing away from the rightful heir. You know that story, how the landowner rented out his vineyard, and at the proper season, he sent a servant to collect his due, his rent money, his fruit. And they beat him and sent him away. And he sent others. And finally, he sent his son, saying that they'll reverence him. They'll respect him. But they said, "Up, this is the heir. If we can do away with him, we'll get the kingdom." And when he got done telling that story, they say, you know, never, may it never be, God forbid. But he said, you know, that's the way it is. They perceived, it says there in verse 19, that he had spoken this parable against them. They were the vineyard keepers who were trying and felt they deserved what was due the master. The praise and the worship and the adoration of the crowd, they wanted. They were jealous of that. And they would do anything to get it. And they perceived that he had spoken this parable against them. Then they began to question him. Verse 20 there says, they watched him and sent forth spies, which should feign themselves just men, that they might take hold of his words, so that they might deliver him unto the power and authority of the governor. They tried a new tack now. Instead of just coming out and challenging his authority, the Pharisees and the Herodians teamed up and come at him from another angle. They ask him a question, again, for which there would be no good or safe answer. Now, we're not told in Luke's gospel here that the Herodians were in on it, but both Matthew and Mark let us in on that bit of information. The Bible doesn't tell us a lot about the Herodians. I tried to do a little research on them. Not much is known about them, but every time they're mentioned, they're opposing Jesus. That tells us something about them. Unger's Bible Dictionary says they were something more than a political party, something less than a religious sect. But they were opposed to Jesus. And they and the Pharisees get together, and they came with a goal to get Jesus in trouble so that they might be able to turn him over to the power and authority of the governor. Instead of challenging his authority, they flattered him. They flattered him. They said in verse 21, Master, we know that thou sayest and teachest rightly. Neither acceptest thou the person of any man, but teachest the way of God truly. That wouldn't have been flattery at all if they'd have believed it. They didn't believe it. They were trying foolishly to think that they could get Jesus softened up to give them a quick and unthought answer. Proverbs 29:5 says, a man that flatters his neighbor spreads a net for his feet. The net they spread came in the next words they said, verse 22. Is it lawful for a man to give tribute to Caesar or no? We can see from this passage that the debate about how involved and how cooperative God's people are to be in the affairs of government and their loyalty to government is nothing new. It was an old debate, and it was going on then. The question they asked Jesus was a very divisive one. If he answered, pay the tax, of course he would offend his countrymen because they despised the fact that these Romans were occupying their land and had their thumb on them, and among other things made them pay tribute. They hated that. And on the other hand, if he said, well, you really don't have to pay that. They don't deserve that. We're God's people. They're a pagan government. You don't have to pay that. That would have been great for them. As much as they hated paying the tax, they knew that would get him in trouble with Pilate big time and quick. And they were hoping that's what he would say, I believe, because remember their goal was to take hold of his words that they might have a reason to turn him over to the power and authority of the governor. But Jesus perceived their craftiness and again didn't give them a direct answer. Instead, he asked for a penny, a denarius, which was a coin commonly used for a labor, for a day's wages, and it was the same amount that this head tax was. Each one had to pay a denarius. And so he said, give me one of them. And they brought one. And he said, well, now whose name is this? And whose inscription is this? Whose superscription? Who is that guy? He said, well, that's Caesar. That's his name. That's him. He said, well, then if this is Caesar's, you give it to Caesar. What is God's, you give to God's. And again, they were unable to take hold of his words. He provided them no handle by which they could grab a hold of what he was saying and pull him down. And verse 26 says that they marveled and held their peace. Now the questions that we might want to ask ourselves are this. Are we sometimes like these Herodians and like these Pharisees? Do we sometimes go to God not really to get the right answer, but to get the answer we want? Do we always have honest motives when we go to God seeking His direction? Do we sometimes really look for a loophole? Something to catch hold of that maybe we could get out of something or maybe do something that deep down in our spirit we know that we ought not to do? How do we approach God? The other thing is we could ask ourselves, whose image do I bear? You know, the Bible says that we were created in the image and likeness of God. And if a coin struck with the image and name of Caesar came under Caesar's jurisdiction, then you and I, who are created with the image and likeness of God, come under His jurisdiction. And have you given yourself to Him? Have you yielded to Him? Have you acknowledged Him as Lord? He deserves to be the Lord of your life. Does your life, does my life reflect His likeness? Are we a fair representation to the world around us of our God? That was a question about Caesar. Next, they came with a question about Moses. The Pharisees had tried, the Herodians with them, they failed. Didn't stop the Sadducees from trying to embarrass Jesus. Now the Sadducees, they claimed to be the followers of Moses. They claimed to believe those first five books that are attributed to Moses, but they didn't put much weight in the rest of the Old Testament. They figured Moses is the man, and what he said, we'll do that. We'll do it very strictly, but the rest of it we're not sure about. They were practically a cult of Moses, and they reasoned Moses didn't write anything about the resurrection, and he didn't say anything about angels or spirits. So they said, no resurrection, no angels, no spirits. Moses didn't tell us about that, so we're going with Moses. They come up with this hypothetical question about levirate marriage that they reasoned would demonstrate just how foolish it was for anybody to believe that there would be a resurrection. Now, levirate comes from a Latin word, levir, which means a husband's brother. And in Deuteronomy 25, verses 5 to 10, it does say that for the Jews there, if a man died who had no children, his brother should take his brother's wife and their first child, their first son, would be considered the dead brother's child and then would inherit his land. That was the deal. And so they told this story about this man he and his wife married, and after a while he passed away and they had no children. So his wife, or his brother, married this woman, and after a bit of time he passed away. They still had no children. And then the third, and then the fourth. He said there were seven. Now, we're not told it was a hypothetical situation, but I kind of think it was. I know if I'd have been about number three, four, or five, I'd have found something to do in that wedding day. I mean, I'd have been out of Dodge, man. I think maybe she's putting something in the tea or something, you know. But he says it went to seven. And then it's almost like they folded their arms and said, now whose wife's he going to be, Jesus? In the resurrection. If there's something as foolish as a resurrection, how are you going to take care of that one? Well, Jesus, again referring to Matthew's account, began his response by saying, ye do err. In other words, you're mistaken, not knowing the scriptures or the power of God. Anyone want to explain that people in heaven won't marry, they won't have little ones, they won't die. In those ways, they will be equal to or like the angels. You know, our bodies are amazing things. What we can do and what they'll endure and what we can enjoy. Tonight we had a good supper there at Straw's Balls, and we were coming down the road and I got a case of the hiccups. And I thought, boy, you know, this is not good. I thought we might have to have an extra long song service or something. But after a bit, they stopped. And I don't know what causes hiccups or what stops them altogether, but I was glad mine stopped. That's just a little goofy thing that our bodies do. But our bodies are amazing things. When we get to glory, our resurrection bodies will be every bit as amazing. More so, I'm confident. There'll be some similarity. I can't explain it fully. We'll have perfect knowledge then. I don't know if we'll use that knowledge or there'll be other knowledge, but we'll be able to discern who each other is and pick one another out and know Clay and Shannon and Glenn, and we'll be able to know everybody. We'll even know Moses and Daniel and the rest of them. It'll be great, but we won't be limited in the same way that we're limited in the bodies that we have now. Somewhere in the whole mix, the Bible tells us that we'll even judge angels. I don't believe that we can comprehend all that is prepared for us when we get to glory. Jesus went on to tell the Sadducees that even Moses indicated that there was a resurrection. He took them back to the burning bush there, and he reminded them that God, through the burning bush, identified himself to Moses as the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. And he said, now God is not the God of the dead. He's the God of the living, and all live unto him. Ye do greatly err, not knowing the scriptures or the power of God. That seemed to put their questioning to an end, at least for a while. But again, there are some questions for us. When we approach God, do we sometimes approach Him as though we already know the answer? We just like Him to put His stamp on it, you know. Just agree with me, God. I know how to handle this. I know what needs done. Just you know, maybe let everybody else know that I'm right. Do we sometimes approach God as though we already know everything? Would He maybe sometimes say to us, you err. You're mistaken. You don't have it quite right. You don't understand the scriptures perfectly. You don't understand my power. You learn of me. The next few verses, there's another question. We had a question about Caesar, a question about Moses. Here's a question about David. But now, instead of being asked the question, Jesus does the asking. And again, referring to Matthew's account, there's a question that Jesus poses even before the one listed there in verse 41 of our lesson tonight. In Matthew 22, verses 41 and 42, it says, while the Pharisees were gathered together, Jesus asked them, saying, what think ye of Christ? Whose son is he? And they said unto him, the son of David. Now, every Jewish person knew that the Messiah, the Christ, was to be a descendant of the great King David. They knew he was to be born in Bethlehem, and that was an easy question. And they didn't hesitate. They gave him an answer. They said, he's the son of David. And Jesus came back with, how can that be? Because David himself calls him Lord. And then he quoted from Psalm 110. And the Jews understood and had rightly identified Psalm 110 as a messianic psalm. That is a psalm that told of the coming Messiah. And they knew that in that psalm, it spoke of the power and authority that the coming Messiah would one day have. And what he was pointing out to them was David wrote that psalm. And David calls a descendant of his Lord. He calls the Messiah Lord. And you're telling me it's a descendant of David. How can he be the Messiah and be Lord, which is another name for God, and a descendant? How can that be? And the question was never really answered, but the answer was clear. The only way the Messiah could be both David's son and David's Lord is if he was that mystery we talked about Sunday morning. God, 100%. A man, 100%. That's the only way it could be. And what he was really saying was, you're treating me like a man. And I am a man. But what you need to understand is I am God. I am your Messiah. I am the Son of David that David wrote about. Still, Jesus' enemies refused to believe. Their minds were made up. Their hearts were hard. They refused to see. And like someone has said, no one is as blind as the one who will not see. That's where they were. They just would not humble themselves and acknowledge the truth. And though we read no more of challenging questions being given to Jesus, we know that his enemies continue to plot against him. In a few days, they would rejoice when he finally was nailed up to a Roman cross. Jesus knew their hearts. He knew they were dishonest, full of hypocrisy, evil men who loved the praise of God, the praise of men. They were evil to the core. They really were dangerous people to be around. Jesus warned his disciples about them in the last several verses, the last two verses there of the chapter. Well, how about you tonight? Are you resisting the Spirit of God? Is there some question that you keep throwing back and forth and wrestling with in your mind, and you haven't come up with the right answer? You know Jesus is the one who came to be the Savior of the world. You know that you're a sinner. You know what you should do, but you're still wrestling in your heart and in your mind, and you're not yet given in. You've not yet surrendered. Listen, there's no argument that will win against the Lord. Be thankful that he's calling you and that he's drawing you to himself, because he is the only one who can give us the gift of God, which is an eternal life. It's a humbling thing to come to God. There's no doubt about it. To truly come to God, we must be broken. But that's going to be a far better thing than refusing his mercy and having him fall on us like a giant stone, where instead of just being broken, we'll be ground into the powder by his judgment. You don't have to do that. You can come to him. We encourage you to do that tonight. What will we sing?